Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me across the water is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
I'm good. Look, exciting time for you, mate. You're on the almost the eve of your wedding trip. Yeah. So you're in a very different headspace to the one I'm in over here right now. So it's more about how you're doing, mate, and us making sure that you're in a good place. We can send you off with a nice pod, all these things, and make sure that you're in a nice smiley mood as you seem to be.
No, I'm very, very good. I'm very excited. The next time you hear from me on this main feed, I'll be recording from Portugal ahead of that wedding. That'll be the last one we do. So
we'll be ranking your fiancé.
Well, that's it. We might be ranking the best bits of my wedding day the week after that, but we'll see how we go.
Okay, yeah, we should be. Go back to the old school. We used to do, what was it called?
Nonsense rankings,
yeah. And then gibberish rankings, that's the one I was trying to think of. Let's do a bit of that. I like that a lot.
We'll get stuck into that. So yeah, I'm very excited at the moment. But yeah, we'll fly out to Portugal on Friday. So it's all a lot right now, like the packing, getting through it. And I'm on the radio every day this week. So it's all been a bit like much and kind of chaotic and all over the place. But yeah, I'm having a good time and I'm still smiling. So I think that's the main thing at this point. I was in Mallorca for a wedding at the weekend 2 weeks before ours, and it felt so surreal, like being there. And we kind of went in and out because there was no way that we could spend any more time there. So we flew in late Friday night, flew out early Sunday morning. The wedding was on the Saturday, and it was just like, even now thinking back, it seems absolutely ridiculous that I was in Mallorca 3 days ago.
Yeah,
like for that wedding, and yet so you're kind of back into it, and you're like, that was wild and a beautiful, absolutely stunning wedding for one of my best friends and one of my groomsmen at my own wedding. So it was like wasn't a possibility that it's not one you go to. Yeah. But like, even the idea that, you know, even recording on Monday, I was like, I was in Mallorca yesterday morning. Like, I woke up in Mallorca. Now I'm just here, like cracking back on, and it felt like a ghost moment almost in terms of it happened and it didn't. So look, it's all a bit surreal is probably how I'd phrase it at the moment. But all is well. Talking of surreal, I wanted to ask you about the Club World Cup, because before we get into today's main ranking, it's been something we've talked about a lot on Sirius over the last couple of days. It's had mixed reactions in terms of not just the attendances and the crowds in attendance and how much they're buying into it, but also I think in terms of how people feel about it in different places across the world. So I wanted to get your view on it, being in America, being on the West Coast, where so much of this is taking place. What's been the atmosphere like around it? There's been games at Snapdragon. There's been games at the Rose Bowl. It all feels a little bit kind of off the pace from where I'm standing.
Yeah, no one's talking about it, mate. No one. It's been weird because obviously the USA had had a game in the Gold Cup and stuff, and that was empty too. I just feel there's just not a good vibe around the game at the moment. And I think a lot of it comes from the pricing, like we've talked about in the pod many times. It doesn't feel like an accessible sport at the moment. And even if it did, they're not doing a great job of making you feel welcome in it. And I think that that's part of the problem. PSG v Atletico was the other day in LA. And I was offered, a few people offered me tickets to it and stuff. And I was really, I didn't really even have the temptation to go, apart from, you know, Dylan really does actually like watching PSG. And so there was that element of it where I was tempted to take him. But obviously there was political issues anyway going on in LA at the moment. So it was like, can I be bothered to like kind of potentially deal with anything that's going to go off in that sense?
That.
Yeah. Ticket prices, they weren't cheap. I know that everyone was talking about how they dropped them, but they didn't drop them enough. And it was unfair anyway. People literally bought tickets for $200 months ago and then saw the prices drop to like $40 in some cases. And actually, some people had their seats moved from the ones they actually selected and bought, well, then moved to different parts of the stadium at some venues, well, they'll have their own reasons for what they say, but basically so it looks more busy on TV. And some people got moved to worse seats and had to kick up a fuss so that then they got better seats. It was just an absolute shambles. So I just think that it could have been a lot better run. And I do hold some fear for what this means for the World Cup in a year's time, but that's a debate for another day. The overriding feeling is that this absolutely has not captured the imagination of anyone I've spoken to that likes football over here. I've spoken to a couple of people that did go to that PSG Atletico game. And I actually posted on my Insta as well that you saw a Reddit post of someone, a report from that game. The Rose Bowl on an afternoon when it was a boiling hot the other day.
Yeah, not ideal conditions is probably how I'd phrase it.
Roasting.
As much as players. Like PSG seemed to handle it all right. Atleti looked like they were running through treacle. But I just felt for the fans like there is no shade in that
stadium. No shade. And like, San Diego FC, obviously my local team at Snapdragon Stadium, they don't have a roof either. But most of the time, they don't play afternoon games. Like, they should have a roof. They should have something up anyway to shield it, but they don't. And the sun's always out. And so I've been to one game out here when it was in the afternoon and it was sunny. And it was hard. It wasn't even like super, super hot. It was just really sunny and warm. And I tried to keep the kids covered that day, and Dylan came home with literally sunburn on like half his face and half his neck, where maybe I didn't put enough sunscreen on, but I thought I did a good job. I thought I'm on this. I'll make sure this kid's okay. And Taylor's like, what happened to Dylan's face? I was like, tried my best. It was too hot. So just crazy, really. You're not even allowed to take in your own bottled water. I don't know, man. It's just like, it's just really difficult to kind of make sense of it and back the reasons around the venues and the setups and the ticket pricing. It just all seems like it's ridiculous. Like you see the Atlanta game where LAFC, an MLS team, are playing against Chelsea, one of the biggest teams from England. And look, it's a massive stadium, so it's hard to feel anyway. But you could make it affordable, and you know Atlanta can fill that stadium.
Yeah, we see what? Attendances of average around 45,000 for Atlanta United games, right? There was 22,000. Now, it was in the midweek at 3 p.m. But, you know, one of the things that you and I have been kind of contesting with over the last couple of weeks is the fact that kids are off school much earlier in America than they are here in the UK. So, like, my cousins haven't finished school yet for the year, but the boys are off already for you. And I'm like, well, surely you'd get families there who are like, if these tickets were reasonable, the opportunity to go and see a game like that in a city that does genuinely buy in to its kind of soccer
fans.
And I think you're kind of looking at that. Look, there are other things at play here. One of them is the fact that Chelsea keep going back to Atlanta. Like three or four times in a row, I think, in the summer, they've been back there. And there might just be a bit of tiredness. There obviously is going to be a level of how are these fans from LA? And you know what? The supporters group, I think, did a really good job in terms of actually trying to force an atmosphere in quite difficult conditions.
Yeah.
But you're not going to get people traveling across country on this short a notice. And I know that obviously the whole LAFC getting in late on to the tournament won't have helped this, but it just feels like they're shooting themselves in the foot in so many ways. And there are so many stadiums. Look at the Seattle game, right? At Lumen Field. And look, Seattle's a soccer hotbed, always kind of has been, and it's flown the flag for MLS in many ways down the years. But like, put it in stadiums where people are like, okay, if you know you're going to get 30,000 people, that's still a good crowd, you know?
Yeah.
23,000 in a midweek, midday, or so mid-afternoon game is nothing to be necessarily sniffed at, but in a 74,000 seat stadium, it's going to look empty. And so if you put that in a place where actually it would be, you know, full on a, you know, put it in a 25,000 seat stadium, it will look, one, optically a whole lot better. And two, it puts it in places where people are like, cool, this is different, this is new, and therefore we'll have more of a reason to actually buy in. Just get it.
I mean, it is obviously a competitive tournament, but it still feels like a pre-season tournament. And that's a massive problem too. An English friend of mine, who lives in Canada, but had traveled down to Atlanta for the Chelsea game. He's a Chelsea fan. He texted me yesterday. I was like, "How? What's it actually like?" And he said, it was amazing. Like the stadium, he said, even though it feels more like an arena than a stadium, he said, and the game was good. He said that there was actually a good atmosphere. He said it was a good atmosphere, but they should have just closed the top tiers and moved everyone down, because then it would have been a really good atmosphere and it would have felt much better. So it could have been better than it was. But he said he had a good time. I just feel like every game feels like a missed opportunity. And the only teams where you really feel the true football vibes are the South American teams, like, because they've got the contingents to get to the games of the true, a more match going fan. I mean, I watched the PSG Atleti game, right? And behind the goal, there was a group of Atleti fans, they all had Atleti shirts on, and PSG kept scoring in that goal. And every time they cheered, they were cheering, right? So these fans are just football fans, right? They just happen to have Atleti shirts on for that day, I'm sure. And that's fine. But that's not generating the same kind of competitive atmosphere that you would get in a proper tournament. Like, US fans are just, if you like football, you're just happy to be out there for the day. And some people don't think anything of wearing a shirt.
I would be going to like the most random games I could find. And actually, this was going to be my kind of counterpoint. The saving grace games have been the games we don't see. The best games we've seen so far, I think, in the tournament. Obviously, the Boca Benfica game felt like a genuine, like, crackerjack in terms of the way it played out, the competitive elements of it. I thought that the atmosphere of the game between Flamengo and Esperance Tunis looked wicked, and some of the pictures of all the Tunisian fans getting involved and everything being orange in both New York and Philadelphia was incredible. We saw, obviously, the Boca fans going mad. I think that the Palmeiras-Porto game was a really good game. And even though it ended 0-0, that atmosphere felt like it was a bit of a Lusophone loving, sure. But generally, I thought it was a really interesting game and a really interesting atmosphere. And even, I think, I would stretch this to the game between Botafogo and Seattle Sounders, which was a really interesting competitive game. And also the one between Inter Miami and Al Ahly of Egypt. So you're looking at it and thinking, what games have really lit up the tournament so far? Which are the games that I've watched a lot more of it than I actually thought I was going to. The games that have stood out, I think, have been the games between continental powerhouses, right? Like, between different continents, games that you don't see every day. And suddenly you're starting to buy into this. Even the Fluminense Dortmund game today, which wasn't the best performances on the pitch from either side, you know, looked like it was a lively atmosphere and it had something about it. They're the games I'm interested in. And I think we'll see this from Wydad Casablanca as well, when they start to fill up stadiums. Obviously, they haven't played yet as we record this, but you're looking at those and thinking, they're the games I'm interested in. And this kind of dichotomy for FIFA between the biggest teams getting through in terms of global stature, as opposed to actually the most interesting matchups between teams that don't play each other on a regular basis, I think is where this tournament is gonna rise or fall when it comes to the latter stages.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know a couple of people who support LAFC, and they were actually Chelsea fans, and they were like, this is so cool. Like, my new team, obviously they haven't been going for that long, are playing like the team I've always followed, and in a proper match that are like, and I was like, oh yeah, that's cool. Imagine San Diego FC played Fulham. Like, that'd be crazy. Like, I would, my mind would be totally blown. And so, like, obviously, as we're recording this, Real Madrid haven't played their match against Al Hilal yet. I think that's really interesting. Like, I think that game is genuinely interesting. And so I'll watch that. But
yeah. Inter Monterrey, which takes place after we record this, like tonight, I'm like, yeah, amazing. That's the kind of game I'm super interested in. There's loads of narrative around that game. There's going to be loads around the Inter against River Plate game as well, I think. Like, they're the matchups I'm intrigued by.
Yeah, I think, like, I don't think it helped that Bayern played Auckland so early. I think that probably set a bad tone from a visionary perspective, because people were able to mock it. Like, you look at the first.
You've seen this on Instagram, but I've been going to war for Auckland's right to right to lose 10-0. Like, they have earned their spot at this competition, and I will have none of it. They should be.
It just shouldn't have been the second game of the tournament. That's probably more to the point, because it started off and it feels like a kid's six-a-side tournament, basically, because you've got the first game, you're excited because Messi's playing, it's 0-0, so you're a bit like, And then you get the next game and it's 10-0, and you're like, oh. And then you get the next game and it's two, like, European giants, PSG Atletico, but one of the teams literally melts and the other team wins 4-0. And you're like, oh, okay. And then the next game's 0-0. And you're like, what is going on? There's no pattern here at all that I can follow as to like the randomness of this sequence of events that are taking place all over this country. So I can't really get a grasp on whether it's a good tournament. I don't think so far it particularly is, but I appreciate that some fans are trying really hard to make it important and make it worthy. And if everybody can get on the same page with it, I do think that it will hold substance in the latter stages.
Yeah, I also think that that is probably a good sign for the World Cup, right? That the fans who are traveling in terms of actually supporting their team and building out those kind of fan bases are able to get involved and make an atmosphere like the one we saw, you know, at Hard Rock between Boca and Benfica.
Yeah.
Like that's a good sign. But I think on the whole, yeah, I'm going to reserve judgment for the time being because, you know, it hasn't followed any particular pattern, as you say. Right, we'll leave the Club World Cup there. And then when we come back, we're going to be talking some big deals over the course of this summer. Stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where it's time to hand the floor over to our very own transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones. Dean, where are we going with this episode? We're talking about some deals that are potentially overpriced, aren't we?
We are indeed, yeah. Ranking overpriced players of summer 2025. And some of these deals aren't complete yet, but their valuations on players are there. So we've got a good idea of where clubs are trying to lay their players within the markets. And some of them are going through right now. So this is an interesting list because it is varied in terms of how they land and why they are positioned in the way they are. But I think they all throw up varying debates that are important to have around the price of transfers. And you'll see what I mean when I start at number five, because number five in the most overpriced players of this summer is Florian Wirtz.
I knew you were going to do this. Go on, explain.
Well, you have to. You have to. Florian Wirtz is joining Liverpool for £116 million overall fee, £100 million up front, more to follow later. This is not a dig at Wirtz. He's great, right? I'm not doubting the player here. If I was to do a ranking of the best summer signings of summer 2025, he's going to be in it. But we're talking about overpriced players of this summer. This is a huge amount of money, the biggest deal we'll probably see this summer. And he is setting, when it goes through, a British transfer fee record. So by that, we must consider that he is overpriced because literally no one in England has ever cost this much money. So he has to be overpriced. Now, Moises Caicedo obviously just can't wait for this deal to go through because it means that he's no longer got that record fee attached to him and he can just move on with his life. But basically, Leverkusen's valuation capitalizes on Wirtz's status as being a generational talent and from the fact that Manchester City were early on the scene, Liverpool were early on the scene, and Bayern Munich were early on the scene. They had no pressure to actually sell this player. They are financially stable. They've had recent success. The player's still within contract. They can sell him at a premium. So they've sold him at a price that is beyond what he would probably go for otherwise. And look, Man City did balk at this figure. They didn't sign him. They were like, we could probably sign three players for that. And they pretty much have. Doesn't mean either that Man City have done the right thing. Doesn't mean that Rayan Cherki and Tijani Reinders are going to be better than Florian Wirtz is for Liverpool. But it is important to point out that while it's an phenomenal signing, an exciting signing, it's also an outrageous amount of money for a player. This is not Mbappe. This is not Neymar. This is someone that could definitely be that. But he's not, for me, yet there to say this is definitely his value. Do you know where I'm going?
Do
you get me?
I know where you're coming from. I remain disagreeing.
Do you think it's good value? You have to. In that case, you have to say it's good value to say he's not overpriced.
I think that obviously that this kind of transfer fee record is always a thing, right? And I take your point about it being incredibly expensive. And obviously with any transfer of this kind of kind of stature and fee, there's going to be an element of risk. And I think that you're always looking at that and thinking also, where does he line up in this Liverpool side? Now, I think it's probably going to be on the left-hand side of a front three, drifting inwards with Milos Kerkez, who looks like he's, you know, kind of done at this point as well, flying forward on his outside to allow him to get into there. How does that work with Liverpool's midfield? How do they restructure that in order to kind of cover the gaps, etc.? I think there are question marks over all of those things, but I feel like Florian Wirtz is the kind of player that, having watched him come through at Leverkusen and seeing where he's been throughout that, he just feels like the kind of player that I don't think will fail. I don't think he's going to fail in this division. And actually, you know, we speak about big transfer fees, right? But you look at the top five in terms of incomings in the Premier League, and you're talking about, okay, Romelu Lukaku or Paul Pogba, depending on how you value that transfer. I think both of them would be defined at Man United and Chelsea as failures either way. Above that, Moises Caicedo, I think, feels like the kind of player that is now starting to fulfill his price tag. You could say the same for Declan Rice. And Enzo Fernandez, okay, maybe slightly less so, but I think has still had a very solid and kind of storied element of what he's done at Chelsea, to the point where you're not worried that that is going to be something that is hanging on his neck like a millstone for the rest of his career. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that it's going to be similar for Wirtz. Obviously, the kind of odd one out there is Jack Grealish, who was brilliant in that first season at Manchester City when they went and won the treble, and has tailed off, obviously, since that happened. And we're now seeing a player who's going to leave for far less than he came in for. I don't think that anyone at City would look at that and say it's been a definite hit. But equally, I would look at it and be like, there were definitely moments where that price tag looked in the early days like it was being lived up to, and then it dropped off kind of from at a later date. But I think that we've started to see, there was this kind of whole thing about the 100 million mark, right? Where players moving for over that almost always failed for a while. But I think in recent years, we've started to see that change a little bit. I think clubs are being a bit more careful with who they spend that kind of money on. And I think Caicedo and Rice, obviously both coming in that same season in 2023, 2024, both have kind of lived up to the point that they were making now, lived up to that price tag to an extent at the very, very least. And so when we're kind of coming into that, as an area, I'm not quite as worried as I was 2-3 years ago about this kind of price tag hanging around a player like Florian Wirtz's neck. Now, I also think from a character perspective, it's not something that's going to weigh him down. I think that he's a player who has an incredible will to win, an incredible drive. We've seen him come back from injuries that could have ended his career or curtailed his career at really early doors in terms of the way that he moves and the way that he floats around the pitch. And he's come back from that stronger every time. I think that this is going to be a success. And I take your point in that you said he might well be in the best transfers when we do that at the end of the summer. And I think he will be for me, for any case. And I can understand why paying this much money for any player, you know, is always going to come with an element of risk. And therefore, by breaking the British transfer record, you're obviously looking at someone and thinking, okay, there is that element of advice. And if you were saying, is any player worth £100 million? Well, you have to look at that in loads of different ways. So I think you can make the argument. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, but in terms of, do I think this is good value for a player who I think is a generational talent in Florian Wirtz? I'd say that I think Liverpool are paying about the right amount of money, and that Leverkusen can demand that amount of money because of how good he actually is. And that I think he will fit into this Liverpool setup and the actual group of players that are there really nicely.
Oh, I'm glad he's coming. Like, I'm excited for the Premier League to have this player. And I think you're probably right. I think he will be good. But it's different to judge him from Rice, Caicedo, Enzo Fernandez, because they're midfield players who don't have stats to judge them by as the same way. Wirtz will be judged on numbers. And he'll probably be fine because he is brilliant. That's why they're paying this much money for him. But if those numbers aren't there, they'll quickly be shoved down every Liverpool fan's throat in terms of, like, oh my God, 4 months in and he's got two goals and three assists or whatever. We'll see. But he has to be in the list because it's such a phenomenal amount of money.
Yeah, fine. Fair enough. Let's go on to number four, shall we?
This is very different. At number four is Mike Maignan of AC Milan. And this is different because it's Chelsea who say he's overpriced. And I don't think there is a single person in the football world that would have raised an eyebrow if Chelsea had just gone ahead and signed him for £20 million, which is what it would have cost. This deal was in place pretty much to go ahead of the Club World Cup, and collapsed because Chelsea refused in the end to meet his asking price. They wanted to solve a goalkeeping dilemma, which they've been very stubborn about and insisting they don't have a goalkeeping crisis. But I and other journalists have been telling them that they have for quite a while now. They should be looking at goalkeepers, even if they're not. And they finally seem to be accepting that they do have a goalkeeping problem. So they've gone after a really good one, one who's won Serie A, one that's got a very good reputation in the game. But they felt that his valuation was being inflated due to their attempt to sign him for in a very short space of time before a tournament began, i.e. the Club World Cup. And having only 1 year left on his deal, Chelsea were like, no, we're not paying it. We don't believe he's worth that. Look, I still think Chelsea will try for him again because they had the talks. They know that the goalkeeper wants the move and Chelsea were on the verge of signing him. But come on, £20 million. You've just spent over £1 billion, right? And about half of that was wasted. £20 million. Come on. Just get on with it. Just get on with it. Like, this guy's not overpriced. Like, there are overpriced deals and maybe technically he is by about 5 million. But are you really that bothered about that right now? Just get the guy through the door and get on with it.
I just think it's really weird. Like, obviously, Chelsea have signed, what is it, 11 goalkeepers over the last 10 seasons, basically in that kind of long-term idea of replacing Petr Cech and making sure he's in there. Now, obviously, this number is a bit skewed by the fact that Kepa Arrizabalaga cost 80 million odd euros, right? So that kind of plays it. But this is about the fee they spent on Philip Jorgensen. It's about the fee they spent on Edouard Mendy. It's about the fee they spent on Robert Sanchez. Now, Mike Pender was a little bit younger, but he's someone with a long-term future kind of later down the road. But if you're spending that on Jorgensen and Sanchez, you know, and kind of coming into that space and thinking, okay, that's what we're doing, then I just don't really understand how you can't look at Mike Maignan and think that he's worth the same amount of money, considering the difference in their stature in the game. Now, look, for what it's worth, I don't think that Mike Maignan was anywhere near as good as he has been in recent seasons in the last season. Now, part of that was the fact that the Milan were pretty dreadful from a defensive perspective and that they felt like they were a little bit all over the place all season. Two managers cycled through, another one coming in now, et cetera, fine. But I think that there is a track record with a player of Mike Maignan's caliber to suggest that goalkeeping, you know, it would be an upgrade on every single one of Chelsea's goalkeeping department. It would be a move that, okay, potentially means that they have to shift someone else on, fine. But if they were interested in that deal in the first place, that clearly wasn't a concern. They will point to the fact that he does have 1 year left on his contract and say, well, what we can do is say to him, if you really want to come and join us, then just hold out and we'll sign you for free in January and we'll make it work from that perspective. And so I do understand the kind of attempt to maybe be like, hang on, we can get this guy in 6 months for free. Why would we pay you this amount of money? But equally, that's not really how Chelsea have operated in the transfer market. It just doesn't add up. All the pieces aren't adding up for me. And I wonder if this is an element of them being like, oh, well, we tried, but we couldn't get someone in. So we're not spending money on a goalkeeper position right now.
I think they'll still do it. I think they're just waiting. They do genuinely seem to have an attitude whereby they're going to be looking for good value deals in this market. We've seen them go for the Liam Delap one. Like, that was a good value deal. Like, Liam Delap's not a guaranteed success, but at £30 million, nobody's going to be like, oh, you shouldn't have done that.
No, it's a risk that's worth taking. 100%.
It's a risk worth taking. You'll see their stance on Mark Gahey this summer probably be similar to this of Maignan. Obviously, Gahey is valued at a higher amount, but Chelsea aren't going to go and pay £70 million for someone that's got a contract winding down in the not-too-distant future. So they're game. They want to see some value around that, and I've heard that they'll do it for various deals. So maybe they're just setting the tone for what's to come in the belief that, well, we're going to get him anyway, but we can get through. We've just gone through an entire Premier League season without being convinced about our goalkeepers. We might as well get through a couple more weeks at the Club World Cup and then we'll deal with it after that. So Maybe it's that. I just find it funny that they are calling this deal overpriced when nobody would have even considered it a problem outside of their boardroom.
Have you noticed this, like, a shift in the kind of attitude of clubs in terms of free transfers? Because it feels like on one end of the spectrum, you have record fees going in left, right, and center, right? Fine. And we've seen them change over the last couple of years. But also, you know, we've seen Real Madrid's attitude to waiting for players' contracts to run out and then bringing them in on higher wages and being able to pay like a fee almost directly to the player or through the agent or whatever that looks like. Are we seeing like a shift in the balance in terms of clubs now having the power? And look, this is something that I've kind of been twigged on over the last couple of years. In the years gone back, I remember there being the entire tapping up scandal with Ashley Cole, right? And the idea that they spoke to the player first felt like a kind of betrayal of all things that football is supposed to be at. Now that just seems like the norm. The players are talked to before the club is even, you know, we see personal terms agreed. And I know it comes through an intermediary, et cetera, but we all know what's going on here. Like, that kind of element of the game seems to have been phased out. And therefore, we're seeing more and more players just be like, well, in 6 months' time, I can go for free. So why wouldn't I do that? And I wonder if that's just a shift in the dynamics of how transfers work a little bit.
Yeah, it might be. I think that you've probably got a case there. But certainly clubs are, I don't know, I'm going to say becoming more savvy to things like that, but sometimes they're not. So I don't know where I sit with it. They just kind of make up their own rules as and when it suits them. And Chelsea probably a perfect example of that one, mate. One more before we go to a break. And this is a player that's still in the headlines today, has been in the headlines for the past 2 or 3 weeks. And at number 3 in the overpriced player list, I have Brian Mbeumo of Brentford.
Okay.
Obviously, right now, Brentford trying to create a bidding war between Tottenham and Man United. We'll see which side he ends up on. This is not to debate that specifically, but it is to debate whether he's worth £70 million, which is what Brentford would ideally like for him. And Mbeumo's reliable. He's definitely that. He's very good. I'll give him that. And he's improved year on year. That's good. Is he worth £70 million? I got my doubts about it. Like,
I always say this about, like, there's a difference between what a player is worth to the player, the club they play for right now, and to, you know, the club they're potentially joining. Is he worth £70 million to Manchester United or Tottenham? I don't know. Is he worth £70 million to Brentford? Yeah. I think he probably is. And so they're perfectly within their rights. And I think that it's fine for them to basically be looking for that. Now, whether that's it becomes an issue between player and club, as it has done for Victor Gyökeres at Sporting by the sounds of things this summer, like, that's a different question. But Brentford, I think, are well within their rights to be trying to get that kind of fee for him, considering how good and how consistent he's been for them. Is he going to be worth that to a Manchester United team where I don't really understand where he fits in the system? I have my doubts. To a Spurs side who have players in those positions who can cause damage, and we've seen kind of be the first team players in those spots. Again, you know, is that a good use of money from them in the same way? I know that Mbeumo is a brilliant player, right? And I actually think that he, in terms of consistency in the Premier League and in terms of being quite a versatile player where he can move around in the front three, He's quite a safe bet. And I wonder if we're looking at a couple of players in this kind of bracket here. You know, we saw that Leandro Trossard move that Arsenal went with, just kind of find a little bit of depth in there and someone who could play across the front three. That's worked out relatively well, I think. Maybe not an absolute smash hit signing, but it's been pretty solid. A Diogo Jota going into Liverpool, you know, at those kind of fees and being like, yep, he's been an excellent player for Liverpool over the course of a couple of seasons. I think Mbeumo is in that kind of bracket of player where he will go in there and he will be a good player for a top club. Is he going to be an absolute superstar setting the world alight? I have my doubts about that as well. And therefore, when you're talking about this kind of money, it feels like a weird thing to say that I don't think he's worth that money to either United or Tottenham, but he probably is to Brentford.
Yeah, it actually made sense. Arsenal were linked with him first, and they've been watching him for a while because I've said before, he kept coming up on their data radars for consistency in terms of his output and where he was scoring goals from and how he was scoring them. And it was like a very tried and tested thing. And as a alternator for Saka and maybe even others in that front line, is a good option. For an look, Mbeumo doesn't miss games. Like, he's got a really good track record of not missing games.
He's Mr. Reliable, isn't he?
He really is in that sense. And maybe, you know, Man United particularly, and Tottenham actually from recent times under Ange, need somebody that's out on the pitch every week. But his record against the traditional top six isn't that good. He's had his fair share of criticism for, not necessarily from Brentford fans, but from people who are going to be harsh on judging him about how he's fared in his output and where his goals actually come from. I mean, if you look at the where his goals have come, like his record against, like his best output comes against Southampton, Tottenham, Fulham, West Ham, Bournemouth. And when you get down to the likes of Arsenal, Man United, Liverpool, like his output hasn't actually been that good over the seven or eight games that he's played against them so far. So again, that's how you surely start to judge a £70 million player. Are they going to tip the game to our favour in those big moments against our big like rivals? And I'm not so sure.
It's a slightly different question because of where United and Spurs were last year. Like, so if I would be judging that, I think that's a fair point. If he was signing for Liverpool or Arsenal or Chelsea, right, or a team who were in the Champions League, and I know Tottenham are, but like, I mean, who finished in the Champions League spaces, they could probably do with a bit of a flat track bully, considering the way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. Yeah.
Last year,
you pay £70 million for a flat track bully who can score against Southampton and Bournemouth.
That's probably doing him a little bit. You know what I mean? In terms of like, they probably just need someone who's going to reliably hit those kind of goal marks, even if that goal mark is sort of 12, 13 goals. That would be a good output. I said this for Mateus Cunha when we were talking about him to United. I was like, he scores 12 to 15 goals in all competitions next season for Man United. I think that's a pretty good return. So if you're looking at a player like Mbeumo who has had that kind of return and who has put together some impressive numbers over the course of his time at Brentford, I can understand why teams are interested in making him, you know, a key part of their rotations. I just don't know if he walks into any of those teams and goes, right, I'm the immediate first team starter, as good as he is. If you're looking at trying to kind of push yourselves back into that top six conversation, let's say, that I think is the strange thing. But in terms of getting them up the table from where they finished last year to back into the European contentions, well, yeah, it probably is quite a good signing. So maybe we're just judging it differently in terms of where United and Tottenham historically were as opposed to where they are right now.
Yeah, it's also a good opportunity for Brentford to kind of price him as high as they can. I mean, he's still under contract for a couple more years. They only signed the player for about £6 million. And so the markup on him is going to be extraordinary when he does leave. I don't think he's massively overpriced here, but I just think that like £50 to £60 million is where I would have him, not £70 million. Man United aren't. It's quite. The briefings are quite clear that they're not going to pay £70 million. I don't know that Tottenham will pay £70 million. And the other thing is that as part of all this, Brentford want a lot of it up front, most of it up front, and that's going to be very important too in terms of who actually gets this deal done. So again, very good player. I'm not knocking him too much here because I think if he signs for Man United, he'll improve their goal output. It can't be any worse. But I wouldn't pay £70 million for him.
No, nor would I. But again, Brentford quite happy to demand exactly what they want for him and quite content to do so. So fair play to them as well. Right, we're going to take a little break there. We'll come back to numbers 2 and 1 on this list when we come back. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks AFC, where we're talking potentially overpriced transfers in this summer market. Two names to go on your list, Dean. Who you got for me?
At number 2, I've got a player that actually makes Brian Mbeumo look good value. Because Antoine Semenyo is being priced up by Bournemouth at about £65 million. And I'm not really on board with this. Now, obviously, Bournemouth have had enough of people buying their players. Yeah, they're getting done over in this transfer window. And I feel for them. I really do. Like, it's a great, enjoyable season. And now their team is a carcass compared to what it was at the end of last season. And it could get worse. But Antoine Semenyo, I can't have that he's worth £65 million in this market. His output doesn't back it up for me. I think he's a good player. I do think he's a good player. And anyone that listens to Chasing Green Arrows, my FPL YouTube show that I do, I always tip Semenyo because I'm like, he's just sneaky good. He's sneaky good. He tends to go through little spells of goals and assists, and he's always there or thereabouts. And he's, when you watch Bournemouth games, he does actually get involved in more goal scoring opportunities than you probably realize if you're just checking the scores, because he's not actually getting in them. But again, his big game impact is a little bit underwhelming for me. And the thing that I really struggle with here for Semenyo being £65 million is that it does put him in the same bracket as Mbeumo and Eze.
That was the one I was going to bring up.
And he ain't there, is he? He's not there.
No, so, absolutely not. Like, as in, look, again, I don't want to talk down on him. 20 goals and assists in both the Premier League and the FA Cup between about 40-odd appearances last year. So that's a goal contribution.
He had a good season, absolutely.
He had a very good year. The year before that, it was 11 goals and assists in 33 games in the Premier League. He didn't really play in the Cup and the Carabao Cup quite as much in that season. The one before that, he joined obviously halfway through and played 11 times and scored once. So, like, we're talking about players 25 here, and it feels like he's come into his own last season. So you're bringing in, I think the kind of good bit about this, if you are going to spend this on him, is that one, he's incredibly versatile. He can play about four positions. And again, we're looking at teams who want depth across that front line, et cetera, who can make a difference when he comes on and can potentially work his way into a starting 11. Fine. I think that's exactly where we're at in terms of where Semenyo is. And I really like him. I really like watching him as a player, right? Yeah. In terms of actually the way that he glides across the pitch and that element of just sort of smoothness to his game. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of watching Semenyo. But in terms of, you know, putting him in that bracket with Eze, that's where I really struggle. That's the bit I really struggle with, because if you could buy in a better Eze for, I don't know, 5 million more, you're talking about a player who has the ability to kind of transform games. And his second half of the season last year was a back to his very best that we've seen over the course of a couple of seasons. I think that if you were talking about a player who was 50-odd million, maybe 45 for a Semenyo, then absolutely, I would be suggesting that everyone should go for it. 20 million more than that feels like a lot of markup at this point. But again, in terms of Bournemouth, losing Dean Howson, it looks like they might lose Ilya Zabani as well now. We know that there are players being raided left, right, and center. They have no reason to sell, is probably the way I'd put it. They've already made the money over the course of this transfer window. They're going to make that in terms of what they sell both Howson and Zabani for, with his deal to PSG looking like it's potentially going further down the line now. But I think that in terms of when they've brought that cash in already, they're like, well, we don't need to sell anymore. We have enough money to reinvest and to buy now anyway. So why would we sell for anything less than what we rate him for? And I think that, again, they're perfectly entitled to do that. Would I be spending 65 million on Semenyo? Probably not. Like him as I do.
Yeah. I mean, look, as I believe, has a 68 million release clause. So, you know, if you're... I don't know, someone was asking me this about Tottenham the other day, because Tottenham are linked with Semenyo at the moment. And I was like, there's only one thing that I could give you that Semenyo has for joining Spurs over Eze would be that he's played with Solanke before. Like, and maybe there's something in, like, they're trying to build combinations. They're going for the Thomas Frank and Mbeumo combination, or the Solanke Semenyo combination, rather than just going for the best player, which is Eze, who's right in the same price bracket. So I'm intrigued to see which way this all comes through, because, yeah, if we specifically talk about Tottenham, then I think that they got so far seem to be going after not the best one.
So Semenyo and Solanke played 41 times together for Bournemouth, right? Mm. They have a combined joint goal card participation in that time of 3. So there were 2,000 minutes. So I'm not sure. Like, obviously, there's more to it than that, right? Like, that's not the be all and end all, and that stat does not encapsulate everything in terms of relationship between two players. But I do think that it's worth just pointing out that it's not like they were electric together and they were racking up kind of assist and goal numbers on the same wavelength as, no, I don't know, Harry Kane and a Heung-min Son. Look, from a Spurs perspective, I do think if they are trying to kind of move to get someone into that left wing spot to be the Son replacement or kind of look at that as a long-term thing, then Semenyo feels like maybe a better bet than Eze in terms of, I think Eze works so much better centrally, right? When he's given the keys to the castle. And so from that perspective, I could maybe understand it. But in terms of, you know, the way that you're building this, and also the fact that Matthias Tell has now signed on a permanent deal, do they see him as a left winger or do they see him as a centre forward? There are still question marks about exactly what that looks like and where he's going to play. Now there's a new manager in place. Thomas Frank might see Matthias Tell in a very different position to what Ange Postecoglou did. And so there's going to be kind of teething spots there where people have to try and work out exactly what they look like in a different system under a new manager who's coming in and trying to make a difference and change the team for the better. So maybe from that perspective, Spurs see Tell as the kind of number nine to go in there and rotate with Solanke and potentially play him elsewhere at other points, but they still want someone to come in and kind of nail down that left winger spot. In which case, I would say that maybe Semenyo, there is an argument for that. But I do think that at that kind of price tag, you could potentially be looking elsewhere as well for better value. So I think that this one is a fair point in terms of where it is.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Let's roll it on to number one, the most overpriced player in the summer transfer market. I'm sure you all know where I'm going. It's Hugo Ekitike. 100 million euros, this guy. Again, a very, very talented player. Not doubting that. I really like his style of play. He's very unpredictable. He's going to get much better. It feels like he's still breaking through and we haven't seen the best of him yet. But 22, 100 million euros without like a substantial breakout season behind you is strange. Like, he scored 15 goals in the Bundesliga last season. Like, Omar Mamouche scored 15 goals in the Bundesliga last season. He left in January. I don't want to tarnish him with that because when you watch his goals and you watch his game, there's more to it than that. But to make that jump from Bundesliga to Premier League, you've got to have the form, the confidence, the pedigree, the status, everything to get in there and make a difference. And, you know, the three top scorers in Bundesliga last season, Kane, Gerassi, Patrick Schick, like all legit. Like, I don't think anyone's going to like knock anyone, any of those three. And then below that, Ekitike is the one you really do look out for along with Šeško of kind of getting into that, breaking into that top three. I don't know, mate. Like, Ekitike, he doesn't have... So, like, prior to the last season, he still doesn't even have a record beyond that of being, like, really good. Like, he got 4 goals, I think, for PSG before he made that move in the season before that. When he played for Rennes and he was breaking through, like, he just about hit double figures, I think. I'm just not seeing output that matches such an investment. Now, again, it comes down to the fact that Frankfurt don't really want to lose him. They know that there's a market for strikers at the moment. They know that they've got a really good young one and that there is interest in him, and scouts have been at all their games. So and they're very good at being stubborn and sticking to their pricing, as we've seen with Marmoush before. Like, they don't want to negotiate. They're like, no, this is his price. If you want him, take him. We've got 3 or 4 big clubs here interested in him.
So, but I really like his variety, the variety in his game, right? Like, so for someone so tall, the explosivity that he has in his game, the fact that he can kind of burst past defenders and make things happen, he's able to drift into wide areas. He was a good creator as well for Frankfurt over the course of this season. And that's not just in terms of he had Marmoush next to him, and so therefore you're working as a central partnership and, you know, the two of them were combining all the time. There was a lot of variation in the way that he was creating chances. I think that we're talking about players here with an incredibly high ceiling. Do I think 100 million is too much? Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Because based on what we've got, but you said it there, and I think this is the really interesting thing. We're seeing a bit of a shortage, I think, in the kind of pure number nine market at this point in world football, probably as much as anything else. And you're looking at the strikers, and this is something I was discussing earlier today on the radio, but you're looking at the strikers who are linked with this Arsenal position. Now, Arsenal have been after a number nine, right, for God knows how long at this point, and the domination of their striker hunt and the back pages is something that I think we're all a little bit tired of. But when you're actually looking at the players that they're into, you know, Victor Gyökeres is a brilliant footballer, but he's not necessarily like a Golma poacher. He's a player who, you know, has that ability and that size and strength to brush off defenders. He likes cutting in from that left-hand flank and make things happen. But I'm sure that you could coach him in terms of getting between the goalposts and sticking the ball in the back of the net. That's not necessarily to say that he wouldn't be a success. I'm still a little bit concerned about Šeško's limited nature when it comes to his shot selection, when it comes to the fact that he just doesn't often seem to pick the right pass and he often just leathers the ball at goal, even if it's clearly not the right option. I think the thing with Ekitike that I really like is his ability to do a lot of different things in the game. Like, he dropped deeper at times this season, especially after Omar Marmoush left, to kind of link up play. It's not his biggest strength, I would suggest, but in terms of just having someone who's able to create different scenarios for you, he has a lot of different things in his game that I think are all up to a pretty good level. Now, he's not the best in the air for someone who is his size, and I am a little bit concerned that he feels a little bit lightweight still at this point, but considering he's so young, the potential to grow in those areas, to fill out properly and learn how to be better from aerial routes, considering he has an incredible dribbling ability and it's something that's really been associated with his game and kind of leveled up at Eintracht Frankfurt, the amount of time he picks the ball up and drives into the box as kind of really dangerous carries, I think is a pretty cool thing for any team to have as a kind of variety of skill set. But I think that, yes, 100 million is too much. I'm less worried in terms of where he's at, that if someone paid 80 million for him, that he could be a player who makes an impact immediately for whichever club that he joins, but also with the potential to grow and become, you know, one of the top number nines in the world. So you're paying for potential if you go and spend this kind of money on him. And it isn't to disagree with you in terms of the idea that right now, that kind of money feels over the top for where he's at and the fact that we haven't got the body of evidence to suggest it in a kind of more regular fashion. But in terms of what he has as a raw skill set, I think that he has all the potential to be one of the best number nines in the world.
I just say, like, if there was a market comparison and you can go to Gyökeres or Osimhen, he doesn't compare at this point in terms of being trusted.
No, but obviously in terms of you could sign Ekitike and if it works, you've got a striker for a decade.
Yeah. That's the gamble, right?
Sure. And every single one of these moves is a gamble to some degree, right? Like the trick is trying to work out where you live.
It's worth the gamble. Would you, 100 million euros for Ekitike, if you are, I mean, Man United can't afford that, but if you were Liverpool, for example, Arsenal.
If I was Liverpool, this is exactly where I'd be going. I think that he's someone that would really, really soothe them. That 100 million is a lot. And do Liverpool have the money to do that after going and spending it on Florian Wirtz? Probably not. They're probably not going to be going and tapping the striker market at that kind of price point. Do I think that spending 100 million on Ekitike is probably a better gamble than spending 80 million on Šeško? Yeah, I do. I do. I think that Ekitike has a far more interesting and varied skill set. He's able to do a lot of good things, both in the final third and dropping deep. He's a player that will be able to, like, actively be intelligent with the players around him. I think that he has far more of a kind of top level than Šeško does at this point, having watched him at this point. Now, obviously, players change and things can change in their careers. And, you know, some people are slightly later developers, etc. But in terms of what I've seen from both these players, I'd be more comfortable taking a gamble on Ekitike than I would be on Šeško right now.
Interesting. I mean, you've said more of Ekitike than me, so I'm going to take your word for it, mate.
I've said it about 50 times, but I just really like the amount of different things he can do, the variety in his game at such a young age. I feel like he's a little bit of a unicorn in that regard.
Yeah, fair enough. Look, he is fun to watch. Like, I do agree with that. And again, I want to see him in the Premier League. This is not my money, so I don't really care.
I'd be a bit worried.
Imagine I had 100 million euros to spend myself on a player.
Yeah. I think I'm a bit worried that his physicality might not be quite there for a move to a top level Premier League club as kind of lone number nine right now. But I think that will come.
Yeah, I think, you know, Frankfurt clearly aren't going to budge on this. They seem pretty set on that. So let's see if anyone's got the bravery to go for this one.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting market. Well, thank you very much, Dean. Some interesting names
there
for a variety of different reasons. Yeah. I like working through them. And look, I think it's fun that we've just sat there and talked about five players that we both really like, and there's still that case of potentially overpricing them. And you never really find that out, right, until about three seasons down the line, if they've been able to come into themselves, especially when you're talking at these very, very top level price tags. But I think that this is the way it's going. I think we're going to see this, right? A market that has real top end money. And then also on the other side of it, what I was talking about earlier about free agents, and it's going to become less of a market for that kind of middle ground. In some ways, people are like, if we're spending big on a big gamble. And if we're not, then we're just going to hold a little bit more and see what we can work out in the kind of very smaller market at the bottom of this. And whether that's free agent or it's a 10 million, 15 million fee, it feels like there's this kind of middle ground is going away a little bit. And I think that's an interesting space for football to be in from a transfer perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Look, I would have liked to have ranked the fixtures for opening day, but obviously they come a bit too late. So make sure you're all checking your apps right now to see who your team in the Premier League is playing, because they are out on Wednesday and there's going to be some spicy ones. There's already a bit of gossip that Arsenal have got a horrific start coming up. So if those rumours are to be trusted, then that could make an exciting start to the season. Maybe they need Ekitike.
It does make me laugh when these kind of things come out and they're like, leaked list. I've never seen a leaked list that's correct.
I wrote my own yesterday.
Just put it on Twitter.
I was going to. And I was like, I can't be bothered with the backlash. I was like out and about. And I was like, oh, should I just do it? So leaked game week one fixtures, because it will do really well. It will get retweeted everywhere. Two of them might be right.
Who knows? Might be like, oh, my source was wrong. It's like one of those. Every year this happens. Every year I'm left kind of wanting in terms of.
Oh, there was one today that went around, and it was like the first 6 weeks of the season or something. But on one of the game days, like Nottingham Forest were playing twice on the same day.
It was all a bit chaotic. So I think we'll wait with bated breath for that, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later on the week over on the Patreon. So make sure you're stuck into that. The link is in the description as ever. We'd love to have you over there. Dean's doing pretty much daily transfer updates and podcasts at the moment, and then some random bits and bobs from me interspersed, although I imagine they're going to get a little bit less frequent over the next 2 weeks, just while we handle some other personal business.
I'll take the reins, mate.
Yeah, you take the reins for a little while. But for now, what's left for me to say, thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever, and we'll see you all very shortly. Take it easy, Ranks Squad. Peace.